We welcome back to the program writer Colin Fleming. His latest book is out now. It's available everywhere, called If You Brackets, Fabula, Fantasy, Effery, and Hope. And if you haven't picked up a copy yet of Scrooge, his book on the 1951 film, get that as well. You'll be happy you did. Colin Fleming with us. Hello there, Colin.
Hey, what's up, Rich?
Doing what we do here on a Tuesday afternoon. And I wanted to ask you first about, I know you didn't see the Super Bowl, but it kind of played out the way you thought it would.
Yeah, that's right. I didn't see a single play. I think that's probably the first time I can say that since I was a baby. But even when I was a baby, I bet I was probably in a room that it was on. But no, I didn't see a play. I thought the Rams had a good chance for quite a while to win it all based on their defense. And although I thought Cincinnati had a chance because of the way Joe Burrow had everything going on. But, you know, one way it didn't play out the way I expected it to was that sounds like the Bengals really had it at the end. Looked like they were on the march and they were going to win that thing, because normally the quarterback's playing well and they're in that situation, they have the ball left and they have some time. The way these passers work these days, you think like, oh, this is just inevitable. So that was surprising to me to see the next day, but to experience it on Twitter, which was how I came about the score, a lot of it was about the halftime show and how Stafford's not really a Hall of Fame quarterback and sort of nonsense like that. So I actually had to dig a little bit to find out what happened.
I wanted to ask you about the Bruins, too. The Tuukka Rask experiment obviously failed. Was that the right idea for the Bruins to try going with the veteran for a while?
No, I definitely don't think so. And you never want somebody to be hurt, obviously. But I think this has worked out the best for the Bruins. And they seem to me like a team that's coming apart a little bit. I've been a staunch defender of like Marchand over the years. And one of the first people, certainly when I wrote for Sports Illustrated, to say that this guy has a chance to be in the Hall of Fame. And that was when he really started to exert himself as a frontline player. But this guy, that he can keep it together when he's counted on for so much leadership-wise. And there's nothing someone can really say to you that warrants the punch in the head and then spearing when you're going to get rung up for a half dozen games. But I think it's for the best with Tuukka Rask. And I'm sort of surprised that people are so pro Rask, and when they talk about, and then there are other people who go too far in the other direction, but he was never going to win you the game that mattered the most. He just didn't have that, call it what you will, constitution, and he had proven that again and again and again and again. He just wasn't going to be that guy. He was a regular season goalie for 50 games, so even not a huge workhorse kind of goalie, but when people talk about him as the best Bruins goalie ever, it's funny because it's like they think the world began when they entered it. I experience that all the time. Bruins had some pretty good goalies in the early portion of their history. And then every now and then someone will throw in like Jerry Cheevers because of their dad. But it's like it didn't start when you entered the world in 1986, sir. It really didn't. There was a whole time period before then. So, no, he's not even in the top three, not in the top five. Pretty good regular season goalie, and let's see what Swayman can do.
I love it when you mentioned that people think the world started it when they came into it. I love the people who would say, whatever the subject, well, that was before I was born. And I think, well, you know, so was Shakespeare and like George Washington and almost everything that's happened.
Almost everything that's ever, you're right, that's ever been is, because I think sometimes like I talk, it's like I'm Doctor Who, like I was there. I wasn't there. I wasn't hanging with Shakespeare in 1599. Like, I think a lot of my interests, someone could be cynical and be like, well, they're old person interests, but they were my interests when I was 15 as well. There's a whole world, and your time is so compact in that world. But when I was a kid, like, I was in fourth grade, I remember reading, like, a biography of Sandy Koufax. And so it was covering up through 1966 and his retirement and everything. And I thought that was really interesting. I really liked baseball. So it was logical to me that here I am in fourth grade in the 80s. I'm going to read about this guy who was supposedly so great. But I don't think that happens now with social media. And there's a tremendous amount of hubris to just talk about someone. Like whenever someone says, well, the best quarterback, he's literally the best. Well, it literally doesn't work that way. But then it's just they don't know anybody really before their time. I was shocked to see someone today talking about quarterbacks they thought were as good as Matthew Stafford, and they had like Dave Craig in there. And it's like, well, I mean, that's not Drew Bledsoe. Like, that's not really, really accurate. But like, you even see it like with Brady when they would compare Brady's rookie year stats to Mac Jones' stats, not taking into account that it's completely different to be a quarterback now than it was in 2001, 2003, 2004, and that whole window. Like, you can take out like 1,200 yards off of whatever you have right now. I mean, Matthew Stafford in 2011. He had over 5,000 yards passing. He was third in the league for passing yards. It's like an arcade. And it's like people, they think it's apples to apples. It's very frustrating to someone who actually takes the time to know.
Well, let's talk about some, not some old guy stuff, some very contemporary music and a great song from a group I know you like a lot, The Vaccines. Wonderful song called Headphones Baby.
It's off their album that came out in the autumn of last year. I think it's their fifth studio album. So the first came out in 2012. And you're right, they're a group that I do like a lot, and I've seen them a bunch. And they were, I was listening to their debut album when a whole lot of bad things started happening to me 10 years ago. So it was like sort of my compatriot in misery at the time. And I remember writing like Dark March and Anglerfish to listening to that album, or at least it was always like sort of playing in between times that I was writing. So this is it's such a hooky, poppy song, and it's not a live performance, so I figured you'd like that. But there's like a lot of times when you're writing a rock and roll song, a pop song, like you can differentiate like the really great people at it from like the kind of okay people by hooks. And a hook is something that we don't really talk about that much anymore. Like, for instance, like an obvious example of a hook, when you could see that Paul McCartney had something, was in P.S. I Love You. That's not like a great song, but when he comes to that pronoun and he repeats it, that you, that's a hook. That's the one part of the song that stays with you. So this song by The Vaccines, it has one of those hooks in it. Has kind of like an all-time hook, and I think someone like listens to it, it's pretty easy to spot. It's around the whole line with the word celebrities, but they're a great band, and no one really seems to know them in the States. I feel like you'd be in the know, and of course, my beanie, my Vaccines, famous or infamous Vaccines beanie, which now I don't even like wearing out, because now I'm just like so like crazy about loving shots. I'm like that guy that I've like introduced my fanaticism into my headwear. There's no one who thinks it's like it could be anything, but I'm trying to signify that you need to get vaccinated via my hat, which is just, it's not even worth it anymore. So I just put on the Red Sox one.
We still put it up there on the Facebook page every once in a while, because damn it, you look good in it.
Yeah, it's but you know how like when you wear something out, people just make so many assumptions. Like I might have told you once that I have a fleece from the aquarium, and I was at the Golden Goose, which is a convenience store that sounds like some enchanted glen, and it's not. It's just overpriced. And some guy says to me, he's like, "Oh, you guys open again?" I'm like, "It's just a fleece, dude." Like, because it's one of those days, like a day like this, where I'm just like not in the mood. I'm sort of like veering back and forth between like panic attacks and wanting to stab someone in the throat. So it's like that kind of mood. So he looked at me like in like total terror and like dropped his big bag of popcorn. I remember thinking like, yeah, you picked that up, bitch.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. And I want to discuss another great episode of yours truly, Johnny Dollar. I love the McClane matter, dealing with a woman who's dead. Where is she?
This is now the thing about this episode, and it's missing a part, but it's okay, because the part that's missing is sort of like with this annoying guy. You don't get enough of him as
right. And I found, I'm like, Colin said it's missing a part, but I don't feel like I missed anything in the story.
Yeah, he's like that guy, like he shows up like I think in like the third part that remains, and he's like, I still miss her, Johnny Dollar. And Dollar, you can tell even he's annoyed with him. But what I think is most significant about this episode, it's badass Johnny Dollar. And what I mean by that is you see how good this guy is at his job, this episode. He's better at his job than any other fictional character I'm aware of. He is better at being an insurance investigator than Sherlock Holmes is being a detective. So the way this works is this doctor in California, this woman comes in, and the doctor has his wife as the secretary. And this woman comes into their office. She has like a heart attack or whatever, but they learn that she has no surviving kin. Her mother died a couple days earlier. And so they're going to have this wife impersonate this woman. She'll be dead, and they'll collect the insurance money, and then they'll rendezvous later. And that doesn't happen. The guy, he stands her up. So the woman is working later on in the New York City area, and she comes to Dollar, or the insurance company, and Dollar's called in, and he sits down with her to talk this out. The progression of his talk with her as she's telling him this story, you cannot BS Dollar. Like, he's all over her, and he's friendly at first, and it becomes more intense. The way he uses language is so commanding, and he ferrets out her real reason that she wants to stick it to this ex-husband, still really her husband, because she learned that he's getting married again. So he ends up going to L.A., and he's able to take a photo with him and have a friend of the woman be like, yeah, that's her. She died like a year ago, I think. And he calls up the doctor. The doctor is so confident. And when he calls the doctor on the phone, it just has one of my favorite lines in all of radio, when the doctor's like, Johnny Dollar says, I'm coming over. And the doctor says, well, if you do that, I'm going to call the cops. And Dollar says something like, you better get busy. Like, he is just not fazed by this dude at all. The doctor talks tough and everything. And Dollar just breaks him down with his efficiency, his verbal acumen. He's fearless, and the guy's like, you're trying to intimidate me. I mean, I find it inspiring. I find it actually quite helpful.
It's amazing to me, too, that Bob Bailey really didn't have any other success beyond this show, because he is just absolutely perfect as Johnny Dollar.
No, it is really this for him. And he had, I don't know if you know this, but he had a sizable drinking problem later on in life, which he was able to lick. And he helped a lot of other people who had drinking problems, too. Like, he devoted his time and his service to helping other people who struggled with alcoholism. But he's so versatile in this role, too. It's not even like a typecast thing. Like, he just is so efficient with his voice. He's so believable to me. Like, when he's talking to her and she says to him, what do you normally do in cases like this? He doesn't even pause. Like, he's just so honest. He says, I've never had a case like this. like he'll just come out, and he's not saying it to be defiant or anything like that. Like, he just shoots it straight the entire way. And he has these vocal mannerisms, too. Like, uh-huh. You can tell sometimes what he's thinking. He's that fully developed. You think, yeah, he's not buying this. You're about to get dollared. Like, he's coming down on you. And when he does, when he pounces, he's a Wolverine. And there's like a coating of like barbecue sauce on the neck. And he does it with just such mental finesse, stylishly. Like, if I taught school, I would have the students listen to this to see, like, people are not good at their jobs. They're just awful at their jobs. Like, I saw this thing, the whole Gabby Petito thing. Remember when they were pulled over in wherever it was out west, and then those cops who did the pullover were investigated by the department after, and they found out that they did like 32 things wrong or whatever it was by the book. If you investigate anyone doing anything, you will find that they do 32 things wrong with every single thing.
Yeah,
but not Johnny Dollar.
No, and he's so quick on his feet, too, when he's talking with the woman, and she mentions that there was the doctor across the hall who came over to sign the death certificate, and there's not a pause at all. Dollar's like, wouldn't he recognize you?
Yeah, he's like, well, and then she stumbles, and she's like, he was just new.
Right.
He was just new, that was all. And he's like, uh-huh. And like, you just, it's like he's tabulating it in his mind. And the thing about it, it's interesting too. The story to him is so outré. It's so far-fetched that he's not even fully believing it. Like, he turns out to sort of like be wrong, but he's willing to be wrong. He's not committing. But when he goes out west and he meets with the guy, the doctor, and he gets this crucial piece of information, he's like, you know what? I didn't even totally believe until this very second that this was happening, but this is what it is. It's like that Holmesian dictate that you rule out this thing, this thing, this thing, and this thing, and the thing that remains, no matter how absurd it is what's true. And it's not that this is this absurd. It's such a well-plotted episode, too. And later the doctor is going to get shot by the jealous guy who had been with the person who actually did really die. And it's kind of funny, too, because this guy is just, he's a horrible person. Like, he's truly, like, just vile. But he wills himself like he's supposed to die. And he's confident that he won't. Kind of a confidence episode. He's weirdly confident that he won't die, at least then and there. And he somehow gets out of the hospital. It's like he willed himself cured. It's even missing that part. It's so definitive. This one's defiant.
Well, let's talk about another radio dramatization. This time of a great H.P. Lovecraft piece that takes place in a fictional town in Massachusetts, and weird things are going on in The Color Out of Space.
Right. So there's this radio production I found of this, and the story is from 1927. I don't know when exactly the radio production is from. It must be like fairly recent. It's not like from the 1950s or anything. It's some like radio theater out of Atlanta. And Arkham is that fictional town you mentioned, and near as I can ascertain, it's somewhere in Cape Ann. So, of course, that's going to resonate with me because that's where Rockport is. And it's not Gloucester. It's not Newburyport, because, like, characters will go to this place. So it's sort of like Salem, a cross between Salem, I'd say, and Manchester by the sea. But he just fictionalizes it up completely. Like, he'll put, like, a research university there, like, all sorts of different things. So this is about a blighted heath, the farm, old-school New England type of farm. And there is something that falls from the heavens, and it curses the land. And really, that's where this sort of, I think that's a good way of putting it, like a curse bubbles up from the land and wrecks the people who live there. It wrecks the crop, kind of like an ecological parable in some ways. And so this guy, who's a family friend, essentially, is going to be our proxy, our go-between, who describes what happens. And Lovecraft, when he was writing at his best, he's so technical. So he sets all of this up in his story very early on in such a technical way. Like, he knew the science. He knew the scientific terms. He must have gone out and learned some others, because he's just building up the believability. Like, you think, my goodness, this guy is like some, like he's in a lab himself. And so I think that comes through to a certain degree. I don't want to be too technical on the radio broadcast. But there's a big sort of gap between Lovecraft at his best like this and some of the other Lovecraft kind of work. So this is, it's one of his finest stories.
And it leaves the horror where it ought to be, I think, which is with the imagination of the reader, or in this case, the listener.
Yeah, there's a big splashy ending to this. Pyrotechnical ending, I would say, but it's New England folk horror, in a way, crossed with sci-fi. And so folk horror, we obviously get that like in the New England area, but a lot of times it's stuff like pertaining to witches. The sky, the heavens, is visiting, blighting the land. So there really hadn't been a mashup like that before 1927. And then, like, in England, all of these films, Witchfinder General and Blood on Satan's Claw, that kind of stuff, and that film a few years ago, the New England set film The Witch. But to have sci-fi, which is what this is, crossed with New England folk horror, it's something that required a lot of imagination. And the thing about Lovecraft, too, and I've noticed this with adaptations of his work, that Farewell, he just was so vocally, linguistically gifted. He had what a friend of mine calls flow. So when we talk about, like, horrible fiction from literary magazines that are all folding, there's never any flow. It's just like shards of glass, like in your mouth. It's like chewy. There's just no sort of like ease of movement to it, where you want the text, the prose, the language, whether it's written or spoken, to do a lot of the work for you, take you, the reader, or the listener, downhill. So when we talked one time about like a so-called vocab word like tendentious, Lovecraft will use that in the context of flow. So he's not using it to show off that he knows that word. And so it washes over you. You don't even really notice the length of the word. I don't mean like for myself. I just mean like for anybody too. So the writing goes downhill, takes you with it, and just by the nature of the subject matter, it enmeshes you in that horror. And it's a pretty frightening story.
Let's go from there to another horror story and a horror cinema classic. 1939, Son of Frankenstein, the third of the Frankenstein films, and arguably maybe one of the two best of all of them?
I think it's probably going to be, I like sort of like the revisionist history angle of elevating it, but it's competing with 1931's Frankenstein and 1935's Bride of Frankenstein, which actually might be going to a screening of tonight at the Brattle. So those are James Whale films, and that's tough to better either of those. But I think because of those two films, this film has been sorely underrated. Its first half hour, for instance, might be as effective as any half hour of movie making in the universal horror canon. Like, it's indelibly atmospheric. I mean, it really is. So you have Basil Rathbone, who was excelling at this point in his career, 1938 and 1939. So like 1938, he's in Robin Hood. 1939, he's in the first two, speaking of Sherlock Holmes films that were probably the two best. And he's in this as well as the son of our original Dr. Frankenstein, who was played by Colin Clive. He had actually died in 1937. So people obviously knew this at the time. I think it would have been like quite jarring when the Rathbone Frankenstein returns to his ancestral home, and it's just the stormiest night. It was a dark and stormy night. There is no stormier or darker night in all of classic Hollywood than you get for like the first 25 minutes of this movie. And the villagers are there to meet him at the train station, and they do not like this guy. They want to send a message to him that they're not keen on his presence. And he goes out to the castle, and there's this huge painting of Colin Clive, who's been dead 2 years. and Rathbone drinks a tribute to him and everything. And it's just, it's weird. It's creepy. And like, you really sort of buy into the death right away. And everyone's great in it. Karloff is back as the monster. But for people who think that Bela Lugosi is just kind of this weird talking, hammy actor, this is where you really see his chops. You see his skill. He plays Igor. Like, movies like this always have an Igor, right? A hunchback sort of guy. Well, he's not hunchback. He just has a broken neck because they hung him. Right. And it didn't work. It didn't take. And so I guess that was the rule. There were no do-overs. So if you survived your hanging, they're like, ah, darn it. Oh, well, he's free now.
Gotta let him go.
Can't hang him twice. Yeah.
Well, if you haven't seen it, check it out. It's an absolutely wonderful film. But you like Bride of Frankenstein a little better?
I think the thing that is problematic with Bride of Frankenstein, you can make a case for a lot of Bride of Frankenstein being enough to elevate it to one of the best American pictures, period. I think Frankenstein from 1931 is actually aged better, because you have this ropey comedy at the beginning of Bride of Frankenstein. And ropey comedy is different than James Whale type wit. And so that comedy hasn't aged well. And there's actually some whale-esque wit in Son of Frankenstein. There's the scene where Lugosi is being, the magistrates are trying to draw him out to get like the dirt on what's going up on up there at the remnants of the old laboratory over like the bubbling sulfur pool. Kind of, you know, something's going to happen with that later. And Lugosi coughs and he spits in the guy's face. The guy's like, "You spit in my face." Lugosi starts cracking wise about like, "I have bone and neck, like it's thick and throat, my bad." it's so funny to hear him do this. Like it actually works. And there's this other sort of whale sort of moment where when Lugosi's telling you, Igor's telling you what's happened to him, he knocks on his neck with his fist. It's so like creepy, right? And he knocks on the bone. And already we've heard from the Frankenstein character, he goes, "Ah, I can't fix you, man. Like, this really messed up your situation. Like, I hope you don't fall and like jostle yourself and die." But it's always just talked about as this kind of also-ran. And it's a Baroque horror film. It's German expressionism. The sets are huge. The lighting, when Karloff first is ambulatory and comes up from behind on Frankenstein. And it also is a film that establishes, like, hey, the monster gets called Frankenstein. Like, we learned that early on, and that's a mistake a lot of people make.
Right.
But it started here.
I was surprised to learn, too, that they had originally planned to make Son of Frankenstein in color, but there were problems with the Karloff makeup, and I can't fathom what it would have looked like in color. Give me the black and white.
You know what also is interesting is that our man, Willis Cooper, of Lights Out radio fame,
yeah,
wrote the script, and it was, I mean, he gets credit for it, but you had the sense that like a lot of work was done off of whatever he had originally come up with. But like, I sort of like up until the 35-minute mark when Frankenstein realizes like, okay, here's the situation. This monster is not dead. And they're in like the tomb and there's some graffiti, like someone threw down a tag and it says something about his father, like maker of monsters, and he gets this torch and he like, you see him, he's effacing it, he's like, ah, and then he crosses out monsters and he writes in maker of men. That's when it's like, okay, now we're getting into like a little bit of Svengoolie territory. But it writes itself after that. Like, I guess audience wanted that kind of like pulpy sort of fun haunted house at the fair sort of vibe. But it really hope, like watching it again recently, and I've seen this a lot of times, I was, through my mature sensibilities now, I just was very impressed.
Son of Frankenstein, 1939 film. Colin Fleming with us every Tuesday on Downtown. Colin, thanks as always for checking in with us, and we'll visit again next week.
All right, sounds good.